The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. We've spent the last few hours trying to work out the best way to cover what happened in Copenhagen tonight, where in front of our eyes we saw Christian Eriksen fight for his life, surrounded by his teammates. Mercifully, and thanks to the incredible work of the referee, the players, the physio, and most importantly, the medical staff, he survived. As we record this at 10 past 10 on Saturday evening, according to the Danish FA, he's awake and undergoing tests in hospital. We will try and make sense of what we saw, whether we should have seen it, and whether the game should have restarted, and what we can learn. Apart from the obvious, life is precious and you don't know what's around the corner. Hopefully Football Weekly takes football the right amount of seriously, if that makes any sense. It matters, we love it, and we know it also doesn't matter. Finland's win doesn't matter, Kiefer Moore's header doesn't, Lukaku's brilliance doesn't matter. But we'll talk about them because that's what we're here to do. This is The Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen, Filippo Clerc, Barry Glendening. Nice to have you all on. Barry, you were doing the minute-by-minute for today's game, which must have been quite a strange and difficult experience.
Yeah, it was one of the weirder jobs I've done for The Guardian, I have to say. I thought it would be, you know, Finland, Denmark, I was looking forward to it. I wasn't sure there would be many people reading or not, and the game just took this very strange turn in, I think, the 42nd minute or something. I think a Finland defender, whose name escapes me, had just hacked the ball clear, as Finland defenders had been doing for the previous 41 minutes. Denmark had a throw-in. Christian Eriksen ran to receive the ball from whoever was taking it, and he actually hit... He kind of trapped the ball on his knee and just fell face first into the pitch. And I did notice at the time, thought it was a bit weird. And then the commentator noticed, then I noticed the referee noticing, and hats off to him for reacting so quickly. Anthony Taylor, a couple of the Finnish players and the Dane who'd taken the throw-in, they all waved on the medical staff. As they do when someone's obviously suffered a serious injury, but it became apparent, you know, there had been no one near Eriksen. It wasn't like he'd been clattered or taken out with a bad tackle or done his, you know, cruciate ligaments. He was just prone on the turf. And it's, I found the whole thing quite upsetting. Briefly.
I think we all did. And I think it threw all of us. And, you know, I'm loath to praise you on the pod, as everyone knows, Barry, but I hope you don't mind, and it might feel weird for you, but reading out a bit of the minute by minute, I know Lars and Philippe have sort of praised what you wrote as well, but it does set the scene for what I think we all saw, starting in the 42nd minute. Concern from referee Anthony Taylor and the players of Denmark as Christian Eriksen goes to ground. I think he just collapsed and fell over as he went to receive a throw-in. This is very worrying. 5:46 p.m. Eriksen appears to be getting CPR on the pitch. His teammates are standing around creating a kind of human screen to give him some privacy as the medical staff attend to him. I think I can see someone pumping his chest. 5:48 p.m. This is truly awful. Eriksen is being resuscitated on the pitch as his distraught teammates stand around him in an outward-facing ring to shield him and give their teammate and the medical staff looking after him some privacy. He just dropped face first into the ground as he went to receive a throw-in. 5:50 p.m. The crowd has fallen largely silent. This is truly traumatic for all present at the Parken Stadium. Come on, Christian, you wrote. 5:56. A young woman, who I guess is Eriksen's wife or partner, has made her way onto the pitch and has been consoled by the Denmark skipper, Simon Kjær, and Kasper Schmeichel. The Finland players, looking very shaken, have retired to the dressing room. Denmark's distraught players continue to form a wide circular shield around their stricken teammate. 5:58 on the BBC, they've cut back to the studio and probably not before time. Gary Lineker, Cesc Fabregas, Alex Scott, Michael Richards all look in total shock, as am I. It's difficult to know what to type here, really. Please God, Christian will be okay. 6:10, my hands are shaking here, so it's a little difficult to type. I will bring you any confirmed news as it comes. It's worth saying again, come on, Christian, fight. And 6:28 p.m, UEFA report that Eriksen's been transferred to hospital and been stabilised. And I think, Philippe, that tells the story of what we all saw.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think I've got much to add to that. And all I can, apart from well done to Barry for being able to do that under these quite extraordinary circumstances, brought back memories of that awful night at White Hart Lane with Mwamba. Of course, that night when was something quite similar that people who were working on the game had to deal with. But this was, I don't know. I think I'm struggling a bit, like we all are, to not necessarily to make sense of it, but also continuing to cross our fingers, pray, whatever it is, because in this kind of incident, and we don't know, I mean, it's important to say, by the way, that we don't know exactly what kind of malaise he struck him. We don't know if it was, it looked as it probably some kind of heart problem, given what they were doing, but we don't know the nature of it. And we know that the next 24 hours are going to be very important. You shouldn't imagine that everything is fine from now on, but, you know, at least we're hoping now. But the speed at which I think you saw the reaction, you know, I think we all knew immediately that there was something very, very serious about it happening on the pitch at that time. And obviously you're brought back to memories of Marc-Vivien Foé and Puerta and other players. And, well, I mean, it raises an awful lot of questions, though. It raises, I think, we've been asking ourselves as well, our own relationship to the images we saw as spectators, as watchers, as journalists. What do we have a right to see? What should we see? What should we report? What should we show? And all this has been, you know, conflating, which is perhaps one of... And I think a lot of the debate at the moment has been probably very heated, because I think we all... it's a strange thing. Why do you feel that strongly about somebody you don't really know, even though, you know, I've interviewed Christian Eriksen a couple of times, but I don't know him. He's not a mate of mine. And why is it that we feel so strongly about it? Why is it that it leads to those images which are both terrifying and beautiful, like the wall that his teammates created around him, which is an absolutely astonishing image of team spirit. And why it leads to those extraordinary scenes we saw in the stadium afterwards, when the Finns and the Danes were singing to each other, was you know, giving his first name and replying with his name and so forth. And you think there is such beauty in this, but it's harrowing beauty. So I guess I'm not trying to make complete sense, because I'm still struggling to try to process all of that, both the my own reaction as a fan, as a journalist, and trying to go beyond that, to see beyond that, and to understand the nature of, yes, what we show of the game. Things can be terrible and be hurtful and painful, but you've got to show them. You know, you've got to harden your eyes, not your heart. That's the basis of it. But there's a moment when I think, I don't know, I'm asking you the question as well. I actually switched the television off, Max, after about 5 minutes of this, because I couldn't take it. And then I went to Twitter to get some information from people I trust. But I didn't want to see the images anymore, because I felt a bit guilty by association.
I just want to bring Lars in first about your sort of reaction to the day, because it has been a strange day.
Yeah, I've really struggled with it. It was interesting that Philippe mentioned, you know, why do we feel so strongly about these footballers? And I think in the case of Eriksen, for me, pod listeners probably have clocked by now that I'm a Tottenham fan. So over the years, I've just thought about it now. I've probably spent more minutes and hours of my life looking at Christian Eriksen do something than I've spent looking at pretty close members of my family, really, partially because I've lived abroad for a while. So I have aunts and cousins I've sort of interacted with, and not interacted with, but acted with, less than I have Christian Eriksen the last decade. And I'm probably not the only one in that situation, because we spend a lot of time in football. And if you're listening to this, you're a huge football fan. So of course these footballers become more than kind of athletes. They become really vivid characters in our lives and in our imaginations, and they form sort of our framework of the world. I think that's why when you add, to say nothing of the human trauma of the whole thing, and I was sort of, I was really struggling with it, and I made a mistake of, like, I was asked to go on the radio and talk about it, and I absolutely should not have done that. Like, I felt at the time like you should have. We didn't know how the outcome was going to be, and it felt like almost we were providing a running commentary to a man perishing literally in front of the eyes of his partner. It's grotesque, really, and it was really different. And if you had the misfortune of hearing that, you probably won't even recognize my voice, because I was all over the place, and I think we're talking about ourselves here. It's not about ourselves, but, you know, I think if you're listening to this, you will have gone through feelings and emotions, and I guess it's more helpful to talk about it than not talk about it.
Barry?
It could have been any player. It could have been some Finland player who I'd never heard of before. But just to watch that happening is so frightening and upsetting. And look, there are arguments raging over on Twitter over what various people should have done. And maybe some decisions were got wrong. But the one thing I would say, from what I saw, every single person in the stadium, from the players to the backroom staff to the medical staff to the referee to the match officials to each and every single person in the stands, they did everything perfectly this evening.
Yeah, and my thoughts also went to, because it happened in Copenhagen, to the current Norwegian national team manager, Ståle Solbakken, because he played for FC Copenhagen when once in training he fell over, keeled over, collapsed. And his heart had stopped. And by chance, the team doctor was there. The team doctor would usually not be on training, but the team doctor was there and could provide aid, and the ambulance arrived. And he was, pronounced clinically dead and was, clinically speaking, dead for 7 minutes before they brought him back. And I thought about this, obviously, since this was happening in Copenhagen. And I think it's worth saying, if anything comes out of this, the medical personnel who work with these are unbelievably good at their jobs. And we're very lucky that they are.
Amazing, Barry. You caught me just then. I agree with you, Lars, about the medical profession, but just what you said there. I don't know what, and it actually hit me when...
We really are a sorry bunch, aren't we?
Maybe we are. You're right. But,
Lars is in tears. I'm in tears. You're in tears. Philippe is maintaining a stoic, stiff Gaelic French upper lip, I think, just about. But
just about,
who wants
yeah.
to listen to this? I mean, come on.
I do think,
We've got a brand to protect.
The thing is that there is no shame in it when something like this happens. And the fact that we saw it, and we will get onto that in a second, makes such a difference. If this had happened at training and you heard that Christian Eriksen was resuscitated or taken to hospital and is stable in hospital, which you wouldn't have heard anything until that had happened, it would feel totally different because you'd feel so distanced from it. But when you see it in front of your eyes, everybody watching, I'm convinced, will be thinking of the people that they love or be thinking of the people that they've lost, and be, you're seeing this drama in front of your eyes, and I don't think that's the wrong way to act when you see that. Like Alex Scott said on the telly when they came back in, texted her mum and, told her she loved her. I think, you're right, it's sentimental, but I think it's right.
I better go and do that now as well. I forgot.
you don't know if she watched the live show on Thursday, in which case that's probably why she's not talking to you, Barry. the Danish team doctor, Morten Børsen, has been quoted by the Danish newspaper BT as saying, "We were called on the pitch when Christian fell over. We felt the pulse, but pretty quickly the picture changed, and then we started life-saving heart treatment. There was fantastic help from the stadium doctor and the rest of the emergency services, and with that collaboration, we got what we needed. We got Christian back, who spoke to me before he was taken to hospital. His condition has been stabilised, according to UEFA. The Danish FA later said he's awake, his condition remains stable, he remains hospitalised at the hospital for further examinations."
I mean, sorry, there is a... you know, I think we're doing getting the tone right here, and it's hard, but we have to be aware it's very early days, and anything could happen.
Yeah,
and we shouldn't forget that. But you know, hopefully, fingers crossed, he will be okay.
There was some talk of, obviously, everyone presumed this game would be postponed. I just could not believe this game would start again. You saw the reaction, you know, that incredible sight of those Danish players forming that shield, and then Kjaran and Schmeichel together with Eriksen's wife. And you think what Schmeichel's been through before with what happened with Leicester City and the helicopter crash. And you thought this game can't happen again. Lars, you've got the exact quotes in Danish of what the coach said.
So the coach said after the game that it was either to finish the game this evening or to play it tomorrow at noon, but then the players would not be able to go home and sleep, so that would be even more unmanageable. They decided to get it over with. That was the choice they made. And he says that he's feeling very sensitive. It's been a very hard evening, and we were reminded about the most important things in life, which is meaningful relations, families, and friends. I can't praise this group enough. They look after each other. It was one of their loved ones who was fighting for his life.
I can't help thinking that this, given what they have just been through and what they've seen with someone they are so close to and have grown up with, that they shouldn't have been given a choice here. I don't know if it's for me to say they weren't right to play a football match. But like we all say football doesn't matter, the game doesn't matter. To be given this binary choice of today or tomorrow at midday, I know we're in a tournament, just doesn't quite seem right to me, Philippe.
Yes, I must say I'm like you, because the first statement I read on this came from UEFA. And when I read it, I thought that after the Danish players had a chance to FaceTime Christian Eriksen from his hospital bed, and they decided to, you know, get on with it. And in a way, I understood completely, because if they carried on with the blessing of their teammate, it was a way to say life carries on, but we haven't lost him. He's with us. He will be with us, you know. And so it's a kind of normality, and normality in itself is reassuring. So I could completely understand that. But this shows the so-called choice in a different light, because that's not a choice. That's an obligation. You're just being given the choice between two obligations.
The UEFA tweet was, following the request made by players of both teams, UEFA has agreed to restart the match between Denmark and Finland tonight.
They left out a significant caveat there. I mean,
absolutely.
I, loath as I am to make this all about me, you know,
there's you've done a pretty good job so far.
There's a sad inevitability about it. I was merely doing an online written commentary of this game, and I was asked by two different superiors if I was okay to continue, and I insisted I was. They said perhaps maybe, you know, you've had a bit of a trauma and you should stand down, and I said no, I'm fine. And that's me. I'm not on the Denmark football team. I don't know Christian Eriksen personally. I made that decision quite easily and was happy to carry on. To be honest, I found the second half very difficult. I was struggling to identify players. I was distracted. Certainly wasn't one of my better minute-by-minute second halves. So I have no idea how they managed to compose themselves, and the Finland players as well, to actually play a game. And I take my hat off to every single player involved.
Yeah, and when it first was announced that it was restarting, I thought surely it's better to take the night and have some hours together to talk about it and try to process some of it. But now when I'm reading these quotes, I mean, and if I'm reading Mr. Yuleman correctly, and if what he's saying is accurate, I can completely understand why they felt, well, let's just get it done so we don't have to deal with this anymore. Mm. And I don't feel like that's a fair situation to put someone in the situation they were.
Yeah, we've touched on it. There has been a lot of criticism from many people online at the way the pictures were shown, what we all saw. The BBC continued to broadcast UEFA's feed of the game, showing what was happening on the pitch for approximately 13 minutes before cutting back to Gary Lineker in the studio with Alex Scott, Micah Richards and Cesc Fabregas. A BBC spokesperson said, "We apologise to anyone who was upset by the images broadcast. In-stadium coverage is controlled by UEFA as the host broadcaster. As soon as the match was suspended, we took our coverage off-air as quickly as possible." Gary Lineker made a similar statement on air before the match restarted. Other broadcasters in other countries, including ESPN, who are yet to comment at the time of recording, have also been criticised for continuing to show the world feed images. Philippe?
That's a really tough one. First of all, when it actually happens, there is, and I'm speaking here from experience, by the way, Max, because I've been in this situation.
Sure.
Not quite, you know, as publicly or as big an event as that before, but as a news journalist, you don't control what's happening. And we saw those pictures. I mean, the first image that made me, and I think it would be a very difficult image to forget, is the player's eyes when he fell. And I can, as I'm speaking to you, I can see them, and I'm thinking immediately there's something really, really, really wrong here, really wrong. But you're broadcasting, you don't control that. And there's absolutely, it's like suddenly you're live and you witness a car crash or something like that. There's nothing you can do about it. So at the beginning, and then you think, well, maybe he's just fallen on the ground. Then you realize, oh, it might be a bit more serious. My first feeling was probably correct. And then there's this awful moment when you realize they're giving him CPR. And this is the moment where they should have cut. And there are protocols in place, you know, both with Ofcom, but also with almost all international broadcasters, which are very clear when it comes to showing pictures of people in distress, which is you shouldn't show them unless you've got the authorization, express authorization of the people who are involved in the scene that you're filming. Now, in a live situation, it's very, very difficult to deal with that because you do not know what you're dealing with. You don't know the seriousness of the incident. And the invasiveness of the process is always going to be a problem. But this is where I stop. Because there is invasiveness and invasiveness, there is the invasiveness of the person who is there on the side of the road, who is just witnessing an event and filming it on his mobile phone. Horrible thing to do, but people do it. And there's the person who takes the mobile phone and tries to get closer to the scene. Two very different things. And I have to say that there were a few moments before I switched off because after about 6-7 minutes, I couldn't stand it and I basically decided to switch off my television. Even though I'm a journalist, we were supposed to do this program together, we're supposed to write about the game as well, but I thought I cannot stand any more of that as a human being. I do not want to be a complicit in that, even though we want to stay because we want to know he's okay. That's what we desperately want. We want some reassurance. But that's not what is given to us. And so there is a moment where you think you've got to take the decision here to cut away. And of course, the BBC and the other programmers do not have the license to film as they would like, especially, Max, we've got to remember this is a very strange tournament because we do not have the same things in. Usually when you have a normal tournament, like in Russia, like each broadcaster would have its own camera people there, sure. And they would have their own feed, and so therefore they would be able to switch to another feed immediately, you know.
Yeah, you often hear in these situations in just banal football matches, the commentator saying, "Well, we're not in control of this feed. You know, this is the foreign director that you get the criticism of."
Yeah, and in fact, I am told, but I've been told by several people that in Denmark, as soon as they realize something very, very nasty was happening, they decided to cut the feed from the stadium into, they had their own feed, which was a drone over the stadium, quite a long way away. You couldn't see any details. So they were still there and they were still reporting the news, but they had decided to take away all the immediate live feed. Unfortunately, the person who was in charge of the feed, the director, decided to take on this really invasive approach to it. Close-ups of, unforgivably, Christian Eriksen's wife, thinking that her husband was perhaps dying in front of her eyes. How on earth do you dare show that? And I can imagine what it is, you know, when you're around the world and you have these images coming into, and you, this is the biggest sport event at the moment. How do you deal with that? And how do you deal with that when you've never dealt with it, Max?
Hmm.
Gary is an incredibly experienced broadcaster. He's never had to deal with that.
Sure. It's interesting because I've dealt with a lot of, you know, breaking news on live radio, people dying. You have to react very quickly. You have to work out, you know, you've got a lot of people. There's lots of fraught decision making. I do agree completely with what you say, and I think they should have cut back to the BBC studio. But like you say, Gary Lineker is a very experienced broadcaster. The panel he had with him are not experienced, and we do not know what the state of the studio was. On balance, it would be better to have the four of them trying to work out what to say and in difficulty than what we saw. I agree with that. But I'm reticent to sort of go in two-footed on the BBC because we just don't know what was happening.
Exactly. When you are caught in events, which are obviously beyond your making, your doing, and you cannot change them. Of course, it happens. You know, the cameras caught up the moment he fell to the floor and the obvious anguish in his eyes and so forth. Yeah, yes, that's life. The moment you decide to stay, this is when everything changes. And there was a moment, and I think that many of us felt that at the beginning you felt they have to stay because we want to know how he is. But there was definitely a moment where you realized, no, this is going to be very, very, very serious. When we became spectators of something else, we were not waiting for the good news. We were transformed into a low version of ourselves, whether we liked it or not. And to remain, I believe, true to what is good in ourselves, we had to switch off. And if we didn't, we became voyeurs. And the reason we became voyeurs is because somebody had decided to show those pictures. And we had a choice, and we hadn't. And that's the whole thing. This is another wrong choice, or another choice which really doesn't exist. The unease we all feel about that shows that that something went wrong. And I don't want to start a pylon on anybody, on Gary at the BBC or the people who were with him or the producer. We don't know what happened, you know, behind the scenes. We don't know what kind of pressure they were under or whatever. The responsibility is, you know, we should be careful about that.
Look, that is a fascinating conversation, and it is one that is, I think we're all examining, and we're all examining with social media and all sorts of different things. Lars, you've got some more comments from the Danish coach.
Well, yeah, he's also said to BT, and I think this is more sort of feeling about the situation they were in. He says there are players in there about the dressing room who are completely emotionally finished. There are players sitting in there when the vast majority said it was impossible to play. They sat and held each other and had experienced something traumatic. So there was something about going out and trying to do what we can. You have to make sure to allow yourself to play the match and dare to show joy and aggression. But it was also perfectly okay if you could say, I cannot play the match. Then we had to switch if that was the case. Not everyone was able to play. It was about making room for the emotions you might have and trying the best we could. You cannot play a football match at this level if you do not have the feeling that it's okay to be aggressive and to be able to cheer. When you have stood and watched one of your best friends fight for life, it cannot be done, says the Danish coach Kasper Juhlmann. I think we can all empathise with that.
Completely. Interestingly, Olon said, and it seems ridiculous to talk about the game, and I've never willed a goal for Denmark more ever in my life, I don't think. Olan says, is it okay as a Finnish resident, originally from the UK, so not quite a citizen yet, to celebrate their win and still be completely heartbroken at the same time? I was close to feeling nothing when Finland scored, even though it's a momentous goal in their history. What was really nice was a load of Danish listeners replied, Henrik, of course you can celebrate it. All the love from a Dane. TTJ, I'm Danish. You're 100% entitled to win and take the points. Peter, another Dane here, you're allowed any feeling you have right now. If you want to celebrate, you're very much allowed. No one in Denmark is paying much attention to the result, but we fully accept it if you are. And the McGinn said, can you call out the tremendous and thoroughly decent Finland fans who spent the interval chanting Christian's name in a call and response with the Danish supporters, which I think, Lars, was just that video was just a really beautiful moment.
Yeah, it's very moving. It really is. And I mean, as I said somewhere before the game, is that we do have a very sort of friendly set of rivalries up in the Nordic countries because, well, you know, it is, we're a small country. So we're keenly aware that it's a pretty big world out there and we're pretty small countries in it. So we tend to sort of, I have no problem, as a Norwegian, I have no problem rooting for Denmark if we're not in the tournament. And I think that goes all ways. And so there was an extraordinary show of solidarity there. And I enjoyed, you were reading the tweets, and this is slightly flippant, but I think it works. I enjoyed the guy who wrote, I'm Danish, you're 100% entitled to celebrate the win and the point, and we all hope you beat Russia for any number of reasons, which I love because it just brought us back to like what football does so well. It kind of, for whatever spurious reasons, it can unify us in in ways that are positive, even on an absolutely horrific evening like that.
Yeah, I mean, in the game, I look, in so much as we talk about the game, Finland were lucky to win. I actually had an inkling to win, but they would win. But you know, after all this, it's Pierre Emil Højbjerg missed the penalty. Of course, he did. He was clearly, you know, distracted. It was an awful penalty. Joel Rönnjampelo scored the winner. Apologies for the probably awful pronunciation, but it's a great win for Finland, which will of course be overshadowed by other events, but they deserve every credit for the way they conducted themselves throughout the game and in victory. And this was their first ever game in a major finals, and it's not one they're going to forget in a hurry, is it?
Okay, that'll do for part one. We'll be back very briefly looking back at Belgium's win over Russia and Wales' draw with Switzerland. Part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's look at Belgium 3, Russia 0. We'll probably cover these two games a bit like we cover sort of West Brom v Burnley on a Monday after we've done. So, you know, we'll get tweets from Belgium fans going, surely we deserve a bit more credit than that. I hope you understand. Look, they swatted them aside with ease, and Lukaku, Lars, was just tremendous, wasn't he?
He's so good, and loyal listeners to Football Weekly will know that he's so good and has really been so good since he moved to Italy. He is a different player than he was for Manchester United in a very real sense, because physically it looks completely different. He's so much sharper, and he's now coming off a very successful season, and it's a very, very good Romelu Lukaku we're dealing with here. I'm still a bit of a mess watching this game. I was struggling to focus the way I normally would, but I did notice, you know, Russia rocked up with a back four, which I thought was an eccentric one, because they've been playing with a back five going into the tournament, and it was quite clear that they were just kind of trying to bolt the door again, like they did at the last tournament. And player for player, if you look at their team, God bless them, that's the move I'd make. And then they suddenly decided that playing against Belgium, who, let's not forget, scored an average of 4 goals a game in qualifying, it's 40 goals in 10 games, 3 conceded, they said, oh, you know what, this is the time to go back to the back four. So some pretty rogue tacticianing from Cheshislav, sorry about pronunciation, on the bench there, I thought, if we can be so flippant about things like that. But no, I thought that was weird. And listen, Belgium are a much better team than Russia. It's not surprising that they win this. It's not surprising that they win comfortably, but it was so comfortable, my word.
It was a nice touch from Lukaku. He went to the camera and said, look, Chris, I love you, down the barrel of the lens to Christian Eriksen. It's interesting you say that. I was felt flat watching this football match. And actually, Eden Hazard did a turn in the 82nd minute. And that was the first moment, I think, since what had happened to Christian Eriksen, where I sat up in my seat as a football fan and sat up and went, oh, what a player. And Kevin Hatchard, the European football expert, had tweeted, look, no Witzel, no De Bruyne, no Eden Hazard. Yeah, you look at this side and think it's packed with quality. It's a hell of a squad, Philippe.
Yes, it is. And I mean, the bad news for them is that obviously the team Castagne has apparently a fractured eye socket, which seems to be all the rage in the Belgian team. And therefore, you must question whether he's going to be available or not. And in the kind of system that Martinez plays, he's a very important player. But Meunier, you know, came on and scored that goal. For Lukaku, I think we have to give the numbers. It's 62 goals in 93 games for Belgium now at the age of 28. I mean, it's just absolutely phenomenal. And anybody who had any doubt that this young man is one of the world's top five strikers, if not top five footballers, needs his head examined. Like you, I was struggling a little bit to concentrate on the game. But the one thing struck me is that, like, Belgium never got out of third gear. They were just playing, passing the ball here and there, blocking the ball when it needed to be blocked. From time to time in the second half, when the Russians somehow shook their lethargy, they produced the tackles they needed to produce. Thibaut Courtois, did he have a proper save to make? Not really. And again, without, you know, three of their main players, because Axel Witsel, Martinez is still hoping that Witsel is going to be able to join in the fun later on. And with this one win by 3-0, they're basically in the round of 16. That's the other thing we shouldn't forget.
It sounds almost perverse to say it, but with the injuries, I know the injury is like De Bruyne, who's unbelievable, and Witsel, who's an important cog. But if you look at what they have, those are positions that certainly De Bruyne, they can actually survive without, because they've got so many options going forward, which feels like a perverse thing to say about a player like that, because he's unbelievable. But actually, they do have attacking options. And this is, again, it's a proof of how sort of like numb we were watching this game, because I have to say, watching the crowd boo or certainly whistle the taking of the knee before the game, I suppose there's another group of people who are tremendously worried about, you know, secret Marxism creeping amongst them. Lukaku just smacking one in 11 minutes after that moment normally would have me laughing like a hyena to the point where the entire road would have heard. But in this case, I was merely just kind of chuckling in like a slightly less jolly animal, I guess.
We should mention as well, of course, that it must be very difficult for Lukaku, who's obviously at Inter with Christian Eriksen, and Toby Alderweireld and Jan Vertonghen, who played with him for years at Spurs, to start that football match, because it would have affected them, perhaps not as much as the Danish players and the Finnish players, but it still would have been very much in their mind, and they all turned up and they all played incredibly well. So, you know, huge credit to them. And that'll do for part two. Back with Wales, Switzerland in just a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. And what seems like, I don't know, 6 weeks ago, Wales played Switzerland. It was a one-all draw. Brilliant header from Kiefer Moore in the second half after Breelan Bolo, who I didn't know a lot about, scored the opener and was really, really good for Switzerland. Lars, can you tell me more about Mbolo, please?
He was once considered the next big thing, and the main reason it hasn't worked out as well as hoped, I would say, is injuries. Primarily injuries, and he, you know, made a move to Schalke, which I guess you should never do. I mean, recent history suggests go to Schalke, your career falls apart. It's a terrible thing. God bless Schalke. I hope they get it together, but that's very much been the way. So yeah, he got very injured and moved to Schalke. So that's unfortunate for him. But now you can see there's a lot of football in that guy, and hopefully the sort of, you know, the rest of his career, he can do more of that on a regular basis.
Actually, this game, the last half hour of this game, Philippe, I thought was really good fun, and Wales gave it a go. But before that, it was a bit of nothing. But
it was dire. It was It was awful, and I think it was like a really good championship game at the end. It's very odd, because the problem with those national teams which are not quite as good as we would like them to be It's a bit like MLS teams, that you have two, three players who are really good, two or three who are good, and others who are perhaps not quite as good as they should be to play for that particular team. And I'm sorry if that sounds very harsh, but for Wales and Switzerland, but that's the case, in fact, for most international teams today. And the technical level was incredibly poor. The level of the physical level was very poor too, partly explainable by the temperature and so forth. But it was, I mean, let's be fair, it was dire until the last 30 minutes, where it was enjoyable, like a playoff game can be, you know, one of those, and a bit crazy.
It was Barnsley-Swansea.
It was Barnsley-Swansea, yeah, absolutely. I was going to say Brentford, but actually I think Brentford would beat any of those two teams. And I apologize to everybody, and I'm putting the tin helmet on, but when you compare the level of this game and of those teams with what we saw from Italy the day before in the same group, it's just not the same kind of game they're playing, same kind of sport. There was no pressing whatsoever. It was lethargic. It was timid. You had some individual performances which were excellent. Moore was one of them. Mbolo was another. Ward certainly deserves.
Yeah, Danny Ward.
Danny Ward was. I mean, he's just carried on where, you know, what he did at against France. But I'm actually a bit surprised. I'm going to stop here because I don't want to be too negative. I'm a bit surprised that this Wales team. The Swiss team is exactly where I expected it to be, but this Wales team surprised me by its lack of apathy, and I know that everybody's going to praise the spirit that they came back and they were under the cosh. I'm sorry, they were really not very good at all. And especially compared to that Welsh team, which really had us, you know, jumping from our seats 4 years ago, 5 years ago, actually. Is it because they're older? Is it because the tactical setup changed before the tournament when they went to this new 4-1-4-1? I don't know, but they didn't fill me with a great deal of hope.
Yeah, I agree with Philippe. My default setting when I watch a Wales game is, what would Ellis James think? I think, I haven't seen him on Twitter, but I think he will have been pleased with that result, but I wasn't impressed with them at all, and I thought they were very lucky to get a draw. Interestingly, Philippe mentioned tin hats there, and after the game, Robert Page said, I've said to the players, that's the foundations now. If we have to dig a trench and put our tin hats on at times, we will do it. And I would argue with Page there that you should probably dig a trench before you build the foundations, because once you've built the foundations, it's very hard to dig into them to get a trench. Now, I'm no expert. I mean,
if you build a trench under the foundations, it goes terribly wrong.
Yeah, because then the foundations completely fill in the trench.
I share your criticisms of Wales. I get it. And they miss Joe Ledley. They need someone with a big beard to kick everyone in midfield. That would be better. But I feel like we need to mention the fact that Big Kiefer Moore has scored a goal in an international tournament. This is a guy who, you know, in the summer of 2015 had been released by Yeovil Town. He got a contract in Norway where he proceeded to play, I think, 11 games and score no goals. And frankly, I'm sure he'd admit it now, looked out of his depth. And I think going from that to having a, you know, very promising now championship career and scoring for Wales in a major tournament is terrific. And it's the kind of small moments that I kind of live for with these international tournaments.
Very good point. And he did it with a big bandage on. And that for that, he deserves, well, he got extra powers, which you get obviously from a bandage. Let's leave you on the message from the FA to the England supporters ahead of tomorrow's game. Tomorrow, our England seniors men's team will begin their Euro 2020 campaign at Wembley Stadium. Major tournaments don't come around often, and when they do, it's an opportunity to unite friends, family and the country. The collective support is what spurs our team on during challenging moments, and it gives them the best chance of succeeding. As the team has reiterated many times, they will collectively take the knee ahead of their fixtures during the tournament. They're doing this as a mechanism of peacefully protesting against discrimination, injustice, and equality. This is personally important to the players and the values the team collectively represents. This gesture of unity and fighting against inequality can be traced back as far as the 18th century. It's not new, and English football has made it very clear it does not view this as being aligned to a political organisation or ideology. There can be no doubt as to why the players are taking the knee and what it represents in footballing context. We encourage those that oppose this action to reflect on the message you are sending to the players you are supporting. Please respect their wishes and remember that we should all be united in the fight to tackle discrimination together. They will do their best for you. Please do your best for them. I wholeheartedly agree with that. We'll be back tomorrow. Barry, you've earned a day off. We will be back, though, tomorrow after the England game and the other games tomorrow. For today...
Can I have a drunken 5 minutes if England lose?
Of course.
Can we record it now, just as a sort of pre?
I'm not drunk at the moment.
Are you not?
Listen, it's been a tricky pod, but hopefully we reflected it well and articulated what we thought on today's events. Lars, thanks for your time, mate.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Philly.
Thank you, Max.
Back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.